I have been chosen for this job of opening and provoking the speakers because probably of all the people in this room, I have the least knowledge of the road to Helsinki. And the best questions come from ignorance. And so I begin my remarks with that caveat. The second reason I was chosen, I think, for this job is that I am one of the only human beings, other than perhaps Khrushchev and Raul Castro, ever to have successfully interrupted Fidel Castro in the middle of a speech. So with those two caveats, there's a segue to why we are working in this format, which is over the last 15 years, I have been part of a critical oral history project, which has changed what we thought we knew about the most studied episode in international relations, the Cuban Missile Crisis. And it changed what we thought we knew by bringing veterans and participants to the table, confronted with often their own documents, and with the often ignorant questions of scholars and others like me. And we gradually created a set of new narratives that began with just the Kennedy administration narrative, which added a certain Khrushchev narrative, which added a Soviet military narrative, which added a Cuban narrative, which added a Brazilian narrative, which added a Czechoslovak narrative to the Cuban Missile Crisis. And what we know now is vastly more than what we knew only 15 years ago. Today is the beginning of not only a road to Helsinki in terms of the past, but the beginning of a road to Helsinki in 2005, which is the anniversary of that moment, and when I think we will all be together, I hope, in a room like this, maybe bigger, in Helsinki, as guests of the Fed, with a new narrative being built, multiple narratives, piling on top of each other and changing what we think we know today about the road to Helsinki. So with that as a brief introduction, let me just pose some questions. Because the fundamental rule of critical oral history is that scholars are not supposed to pontificate. Now this is against everything in our characters. In fact, this rebukes decades of training. This is a contradiction to our very essence. But our job in this process is to ask questions, because the part of the narrative that is not fleshed out is the narrative of the people at this table. So let me start with some questions for some particular people. For me, having now read through much, I admit, not all, of the briefing book, you can see I marked it up last night. But I've been in a tutorial the last couple of weeks with Bill Burr of the National Security Archive in Washington, reading all the Kissinger transcripts. And so I have a, what one might say, perverse view of Helsinki. Let me just give you one quote of that. This is from Herman Sonnenfeld, which I think was a fairly accurate representation of Kissinger, and perhaps Nixon. My own view is there is only one marginal interest that the U.S. can have in the entire ghastly affair, meaning the road to freedom. Conceivably, we can contribute slightly to freedom of action for the East European by some rhetorical devices and some constraints and so forth. But beyond this, our only aim is to avoid splitting off. Sonnenfeld on Soviet motivation. This is the first set of questions I have for Ambassador Dubinin and Castro, because the mystery to me, reading Kissinger, is why the Soviets wanted this so badly. Sonnenfeld speculates that, quote, the European conference pulled out on a grand stage of five ministers' conferences and meetings at Texas State will evoke images of the great 19th century Congress on the concert of Europe. This imagery is irresistible to the Russian leaders, and if only for this reason, they will pursue the conference with finality. What I found most interesting was in comparing that to the wonderful paper that Ambassador Kraschnov gave at Geneva just a year ago, in which he said specifically that the motive behind the conference was that Gromyko had managed to convince Gracia that the fact of him signing together with the leaders of other 34 states of a document tantamount to a post-war peace treaty would not only be a great victory for Soviet foreign policy, but would include Brezhnev personally into the ranks of recognized world leaders. So, how important was that dynamic? This is the quotation that Ambassador Moravka uses in his chapter on the actual speeches at Helsinki. The hour has come! Almost the hour has come at last from Brezhnev. How much was that the motive versus the intention to save Molotov in 1954 to bring tensions to the Alliance, or the motivations of Rokossi in 1964 to bring Poland into a pan-European reality? What were the Soviet motivations that moved this discussion from the realm of propaganda to the realm of actual negotiations? What were the differences within the pact, the Warsaw Pact, about this process? And Ambassador Ekubescu should be able to speak, for example, to the Romanian dynamic, which I think in Moravka's inimitable phrase, he says that Romanians played a double role, that in terms of confidence-building measures and insistence on non-intervention, the Romanians were protecting themselves against the Soviets. But on Basket 3, human rights, career, connections between people, the Romanians were more Soviet than the Soviets. The fascinating dynamic, and I'd like to ask about the Romanian perception and motivation for moving from propaganda to discussion. For Ambassador Whitby, who wrote a lovely paper which I just got last night and read with great interest because the footnotes are a roadmap to the Bureau of European Affairs process of driving what Sonnenfeld, with Fred Selvage, is the one who's found this document, and we need to put it in the next version of the Greek book, but in late 1969 or early 1970, Sonnenfeld writes a memo to Kissinger, the title of which says a lot about Ambassador Whitby's talents, and the title is European Security Conference, colon, the bureaucratic steamroller moves forward. Fascinating. We brought together with the Moravka book to have not one U.S. foreign policy, but at least two U.S. foreign policies taking place, one sort of underground and one out of the Oval Office. That was interesting dynamic. So my question to Ambassador Whitby's paper is about how did Basket 3 ideas really become so central to the debate? Where did these notions of human rights, freer movement of peoples and ideas, where did those really come from? Because in the Whitby paper, the total is one of the breakfast, they kind of drop out of the sky like a deus ex machina. In an April 18, 1970 memoranda from the Bureau of European Affairs to a NATO mission, I will be misquoted precisely, but where did that come from? Who was it in Washington who expressed it in this way? Before this memo, the words have been a French formulation of just expanded context. But this, I think, I agree with Ambassador Whitby, this was a transformation of the notion of cultural exchanges into something more dramatic and more principled and ultimately far more subversive to the Soviet Union. Similarly, I wanted to ask Ambassador Moravka about these two different policies. You have, I think it's the Gorkov's phrase, that as U.S.-Soviet relations improved, it became impossible for Kissinger and Nixon to resist was intent on European security conflict. And at the same time, the White House policy, but not the State Department policy, left out human rights as a concern. I want to ask about those two tracks because one of the questions posed by the organizers is, why did the U.S. wait until 1975 to play such an active role in negotiations? And that's not quite right, because if you look at the Bureau of European Affairs documentation, there was a very active role, starting from 70 to 72, driving NATO solution. And so to the two American representatives, I want to ask about the two tracks and the origin of the human rights idea. And then similarly, to Ambassador Goodwin, Ambassador Goodwin said those policy was the critical step in moving the life of the CFPB, the critical step. And he also mentioned that, in effect, the bilateral negotiations between Bronze and Poles and GDR produced practically everything they were able to get out of a European conference. And so, what were the motivations of Brandt in the new German government after October 69? Why drive this dynamic? How much was it influenced by the signals from Washington that Nixon was interested in a new relationship? How much of that motivation was trying to make sure the U.S. and the Soviets did not make a combination? How much did Braun and Scheele share that fear of a superpower condominium? And then, to what degree were their internal dynamics vis-a-vis the GDR and Poland driving that? And likewise, to Ambassador Andriani, there's been a long-standing interest by De Gaulle in expanding state trade contacts, the bilateral, the Soviet Union, expanding the relationship. And the Republic is starting in 1959 has changed to a more of a pan-European approach. And what were his motivations? What were the French motivations to shift? And how much was there, again, the fear of Washington cutting the deal separately. And finally, because I've had a brief look at the British materials, and there are three volumes produced by the Foreign Commonwealth Office of the British records on the road to Helsinki. And they're fascinating materials because in my quick review, it shows a consistent role for the British up to the point of the new Wilson government in the mid-70s. Almost a self-described role written as the Cassandra to the Western alliance, the Dowers. They expelled 105 Soviet diplomats in 1971, creating a huge scandal and a real chill in British-Soviet relations. There are suspicions in Whitehall of Soviet motivations with the alliance. And so one of my questions to Ambassador Breakwell and to Carol are, what will it look like for London, the attempts by the U.S. to make this happen? What's Britain really performing this role of warning, of Cassandra, of hold on, a role that later on Prime Minister Thatcher at first played and then becomes the first to switch? It's almost eerie parallel to see these warnings in the early 70s and then Harold Wilson performing the role of Thatcher played in blessing Gorbachev. You see the interesting flips in British perspective on the Soviet Union. And finally, I would just, the unknown pieces, at least to me, and this is to totally betray my ignorance and American chauvinism, is the role of the Swiss, the role of the Italians, and those documents, and that document reader, I look forward to putting this number of sticking in. But let me just end with an interesting quote from a document that Svetlana Severinskaya found in the Volkovana papers in Washington, and it's Brezhnev. Now, I'm violating the shared rules here, because we're supposed to focus in this session on motivations leading up to negotiations, and this is a document from 1975. But it's Brezhnev talking to his Warsaw Pact friends, wherein Kuznets, Zhukov, Tatar, and Kadyrov, March 1875, in Budapest. After the stroke, after the Vladivostok seizure, But if there's discussion of how important the European Security Conference is to him, he actually says, we discussed the question of the military parade. Now, this is the military parade on the 30th anniversary of the Soviet victory in World War II, the Great Patriotic War. This is the parade that takes over Red Square, where everyone comes out with their medals, the defining moment of the Soviet Union, the high point of Soviet credibility in the international sphere, I would say, will diminish gradually over the decades thereafter. Brezhnev said, we discussed this question of this parade, and we concluded it would be inexpedient to have this parade. Quote, there is no need to rattle the tanks and missiles along the square, meaning Red Square, in this period of a crucial struggle for peace, which we started in the international. What the European Security Conference meant to Brezhnev was we canceled the celebration of winning the Great Patriotic War for this. And meanwhile, on the other side of the Atlantic, Henry Kissinger, with his staff in December 1974, I couldn't care less what they do in the European Security Conference. They could write it and stop you for all I care. That isn't the point to me at all. The conference can never end up with a meaningful document. And I think precisely because it wasn't meaningful, it seems to me totally undermining confidence. Or am I wrong? That is the question. What do you want? Thank you. Thank you very much for the community remarks from London. Now, I think that the first people we want is to give the floor to those of you who are willing to speak. The Spanish, I'm not speaking. But I wonder if there is someone else who is willing to work with you. Another reason. And you as well. I follow the order. We are number 5 on the list of the